Hello, friends of Poem Talk. This is Al Filreis, and we're excited now to present episode 19 of our series, a session on Bob Perlman's The Unruly Child. First, we wanted to warn you that there's a very slight echo in the recording. You might not even hear it, but if you do, we apologize, and we've made sure all our other Poem Talk recordings are clean. You can read more about each Poem Talk episode at poemtalk.org or at poetryfoundation.org. I'm Al Filreis, and this is Poem Talk at the Writer's House, where I have the pleasure of convening three friends in the world of contemporary poetry and poetics to collaborate on a close but not too close reading of a poem. We'll talk, maybe even disagree a bit, and perhaps open up the verse to a few new possibilities, and we hope gain for a poem that interests us some new readers and listeners. And I say listeners because Poem Talk poems are available in recordings made by the poets themselves as part of our Penn Sound archive, writing.upenn.edu/pennsound. Today I'm joined here in Philadelphia in our third floor garret studio of this 1851 cottage called the Kelly Writer's House by Sarah Dowling from Regina, Saskatchewan, Canada, with recent schooling at Temple University and here at Penn, whose work has appeared in How To, Envision, Q, The Mitre, West Coast Line, and elsewhere. And by Tom Mandel, who once studied with Arendt and Bellow in Chicago, later a big part of the Bay Area scene, one of the authors of The Grand Piano, that experimental collective autobiography, whose recent work, To the Cognoscenti, was published in 2007. Tom works in social software and new media and is an entrepreneur and tech industry consultant. And by Rodrigo Toscano, originally from Southern California, who works in Manhattan at the Labor Institute, lives in Brooklyn, whose books Platform, The Disparities, and Partisans are always right up front on my poetry shelves, whose newest book is Collapsible Poetics Theater, of which we're all asking, can the poem be tested any further? Welcome, all three of you, to Poem Talk. Sarah, your first time on Poem Talk. Thanks for coming. Did I pronounce your hometown right?
It's actually Regina.
It's Regina. Yes. It's a mistake a lot of people make, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's some people call it the city that rhymes with fun.
Okay, we won't go any further with that one. Thanks for coming up from A Point South, Tom. It's good to see you again at the Writer's House.
Oh, it's great to be here.
And thanks, Rodrigo, for taking the train down. This is your first time on Poem Talk, And I have to ask you, can the poem be tested any further?
Well, that we'll find out.
We'll find out today?
Yes.
You think Perlman tests the poem?
I think so.
Okay, good. Anyway, you're here, and so it'll get tested somehow. Our poem today is Bob Perlman's The Unruly Child, which was published in his 1984 book, To the Reader. We know that Perlman himself likes the poem well enough to have included it in his selected poems, titled 10 to 1 and published by Wesleyan. Our recording was made in 2004 here, part of a reading and conversation recorded specifically for Pennsound with a group of undergraduate students. So let's now listen to Bob Perlman reading The Unruly Child.
The Unruly Child. There is a company called Marathon Oil, Mother, very far away and very big and again very desirable. Who isn't? Back connecting pure dots, fleecy intelligence lapped in explanatory sound the faces make difficult. Learn the language. That beautiful, tongue-in-cheek hostage situation. My mind, up close, in PJs, and I use it. Wanting to fuck an abstraction 9 times in a row, continuous melismata, don't stop, no name, no picture. There is a series of solids, Mother, called people who rise to the transparent, obtainable solo windows, mornings, afternoons. And there are military operations called Operation Patio, Operation Menu. It is the individuals who finally get the feel of the tenses, so that it may snow, has to snow, on the muddy corpse. There is a boundary, Mother, very far away and very continuous, broken, to interrogate civilians, the self, the text. Networks of viewers found wanting a new way to cook chicken, why not, to kill while falling asleep. There is the one language not called money, and the other not called explosions.
Sarah, what do we do with this address to the mother? Where do we start with that, do you think?
Well, when I first read the poem to myself, I took the address to the mother to be sort of ironic and playful, something that sort of fit in with the who isn't and why not, the kind of offhand questions that are a little bit kind of flippant or a little bit silly. So I was really struck when I listened to the recording by how kind of mournful the tone of the poem was. And suddenly that unexpected change in the tone made me think about that address to the mother in a totally different way, where it could still be a little bit funny or a little bit flippant, but it seemed like the sort of sadness to it was a lot more striking and a lot more important than I had initially thought.
What would he be mourning?
Well,
what would the speaker be mourning?
I think that's one of the sort of hard questions of the poem. There are a lot of different kind of possible answers that we could give, but one kind of further question that it led me toward was who the unruly child was. And I was started thinking about if the unruly child is the speaker, then what's the sort of difficulty of the unruly child's relation to his mother? Obviously, in many ways, it's easier to be the good child and not to get on your mother's nerves. But I think the poem sort of asks us what's hard and what's necessary about being the unruly child, about being the one who doesn't obey, who misbehaves, but still kind of loves the mother.
It's great. Anybody want to,
Tom
Rodrigo, say something about the word unruly for starters? I mean, it's a great word.
Yeah. No, to me, the poem is a typical, it's typical of Bob in the sense of combining this incredible exuberance and impatience and, you know, finesse and boldness that are really hallmarks of his work. He's the unruly child. I mean, let's, treating the poem for a moment without any kind of theoretical overload where, you know, it really can't be a person. Let's just treat it, as it were, bluntly. He's the unruly child, and the poem is a poem in which he evokes Cesar Vallejo's great, great poem, The Right Meaning, a prose poem from Poemas Humanas, written in the late 30s, to his mother that starts out, Mother, there is a city, it's called Paris, it's very far away, it's very big and very far away. He quotes it, and he uses lines from that all the way through the poem. When I first read this poem in the early 80s, actually it drove me completely crazy. I was really upset by it because Vallejo's poem is so desperate and written in such a desperate situation, and Bob seemed to be so flippant. And really, it's only today and yesterday, reading the poem for this presentation, that I finally understood that what he's doing here is trying to become a poet of politics, trying to get rid of the poet, if you will, and this is probably overstated, the poet of seven works or of his early work, who is wanting to fuck an abstraction nine times in a row, who's you know, wanting to be down in the infrastructure.
So your first response, Tom, was you were impatient with this young guy claiming the Vallejoan tradition of really missing his mother in the desperate political situation, well, and had earned that right, and you're saying that Bob hadn't earned it.
Well, yeah, I don't think I felt anything quite as formed as that. I think I probably felt, Bob, bourgeois politics, something
right,
like that.
Right, right. Rodrigo, are you impatient with a political poem like this? It seems to have a double tone.
No, I think it's a way of Bob framing sort of the instabilities that come from thinking about the intersection between poetic language and political circumstance.
There is a company called Marathon Oil, Mother. Very far away and very big, and again, very desirable. Who isn't? Back connecting pure dots, fleecy intelligence lapped in explanatory sound the faces make difficult.
So let's take what we just did and go back to the address to the mother so that we're really clear about this. Mm. The Vallejo is so good because I think desperate is the right word. I think you used that word.
Well, and plus, when he wrote it, his mother had been dead for almost 20 years.
She died in 1920, yeah. And it was published in 1939, so somewhere in the late 30s. And he's been in Paris. So
right.
He, in a way, you have this a Peruvian poet in Paris in the 30s missing his mother and saying, it's kind of a mama, mama, you know, sort of thing, like when things really come push to shove, my poem calls for the mama. He wants to go back, but he also wants to establish the distance. And when I asked Bob Perlman about that, he didn't remember a whole lot about the poem. But he, I think that's the unruly child again. But let me just finish this thought, Rodrigo. He said, I wanted both the Vallejo sense of longing, and also I wanted to establish distance. I wanted to. I wanted both those things. And when you take Paris and make it Marathon Oil, not only does it become American and much more focused on American capital, and you know Bob's from Ohio, and whether he knows it or not, Marathon Oil started in Ohio. It's a Rockefeller thing, and then have that connected to the mother, the most intimate thing. You have a real mixed message.
Yeah, right, a sense of horror. I think also. You know, it wouldn't surprise me if at the time when Bob wrote this that he struck on the simultaneity of Paris being sort of the site of international, you know, modernism at that time. And I think he wants to preserve that moment. You know, it's a great opportunity to talk about the advent and circumstance of literature at large while at the same time sort of transposing the moment, like you said, out into... you know, a different scale of causality and stuff like that. Tom?
Yeah. I think, you know, I don't remember whether I said this on air or before. I think of it as quite a self-critical poem. And he identifies himself first with language, and then in the final stanza, he says, you know, it is the individuals who finally get the feel of the tenses. You know, there's the poet, and then there's the people who are suffering under whatever the political particulars of Marathon Oil are here, and I remember something about that. But
so how does mother help us with the whole, I mean, Bob Perlman in many of his poems, particularly this period, is interested in, and I almost would say obsessed with, the personal history, even if it's not literally autobiographical, the personal history of the socialization of the child to the adult, learning the language, learning the politics. And the person who taught you the language was your mother or your father or your family. So, Sarah, I'm turning to you. Very desirable. There is a company called Marathon Oil, Mother, very far away and very big, and again, very desirable. What's desirable about Marathon Oil? I mean, it's got to be ironic, right?
Well, I think it does have to be ironic, but what's interesting to me about the word desirable is its position as the first word in the line. It gets a capital D. So it has this really strong charge, which on the one hand, I think just as you said, we have to see it as ironic. But on the other hand, if this is spoken by the unruly child, it gives me the sense that perhaps the unruly child wants to talk about what is desirable and whether or not he's able to desire these things that other people do find capital D desirable. So many people might find Marathon Oil desirable because it brings them wealth. But the unruly child sort of places this extra emphasis on desirable and says to his mother in this sort of very mournful way, sorry, I don't. So I get the sense that part of what the work this poem is trying to do is to sort of say you can recognize that something is desirable to others. Maybe you can even feel sad that you don't desire it. But you have to sort of point out that it's not desirable to you and ask questions about what it is and why is it not desirable. I think it's interesting that Marathon Oil, along with Operation Patio and Operation Menu, get these capital letters that are sort of... that aren't given to other words. I looked up Operation Patio and Operation Menu. They predate me, but I found out they were both...
They're real operations.
Yeah, they're bombing campaigns
in Vietnam. Oh, darn. I was hoping they would be just little domestic things. They're Vietnam-era operations.
Yeah, yeah.
With domestic names.
Right.
Sweet little suburban names.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There is a series of solids, Mother, called people, who rise to the transparent, obtainable solo windows, mornings, afternoons. And there are military operations called Operation Patio, Operation Menu.
So let's add up the political references. I mean, Marathon Oil, I suppose, in context, is just overtly political. But now we have these operations. You have a hostage situation. What else do we have? Interrogating citizens. I mean, this, you mentioned 1979. This is a real late 70s, early 80s hostage situation that we know what that refers to.
Right. There was a spate of them, you know, and the, obviously the Tehran, you know, student uprising.
And Bob, in thinking about this poem.
There's a colon there after which comes my mind up close in PJs, and I use it. So there's a sense in which that's the hostage situation being talked about.
So is it possible, let me just be really simple-minded here, is it possible that as a little turn after that colon, instead of thinking about something overtly on the political landscape, he's conjuring up the domestic scene of the unruly child growing up? This poem is addressed to the mother, after all. Possible.
I think that he just crosses languages. I would even go so far to say is that the unruly child is a sort of a place for language to sort of shake out at, you know, periods of instability, like a transition from one historical moment to the next, and it seems to want to reset. You know, the terms under which he is willing to talk politically.
Reset so like, yeah, from
like
a, what
yeah,
to
it's
what?
Like negotiating with himself. Like that's the hostage situation that I see. He's trying to renegotiate, like, how he's going to be a hostage to representation and so forth.
Oh, I couldn't agree more.
Learn the language. That beautiful, tongue-in-cheek hostage situation. My mind. Up close, in PJs, and I use it. Wanting to fuck an abstraction 9 times in a row, continuous melismata, don't stop, no name, no picture.
I feel like it's a very unstable moment in the poem. You know, don't stop, no name, no picture. It's a sort of a blank spot, like a vacuum where like almost everything gets evacuated.
Interesting. Which, you know, and the next stanza starts to talk in Genesis talk, you know.
Right.
There's a series of solids, mother. Let's start over and understand what the world is. I mean, it's not simply that I'm, you know, a Freudian or Lacanian or mother freak. I really see the relationship between Bob's coming of age as a language poet, which is to say a poet who understands the relationship between socialization and language and politics. And this address to the mother as a way, it may only be a figure, it may only be a metaphor, but you know, when you know, let me just quote from to my mother. I think Bob's is very interested in the mother, and this is from the future memory, and his mother has died, so he's really in the Vallejo situation by this point. And I'll quote the end of a poem called To My Mother. People are real, me too, and I know the real one goes cold at the end. It's written into the pen stroke I, the letter I pronoun, or body or language uses to divide knowledge. Before teaching me social location, you died and undid the difference between now and then. To me, the reference to teaching me social location has its match in Learn the Language, which seems to be an address to the unruly child himself. When you force yourself to learn the language, especially with mother in the background, you become normally you become the ruly child. You become the politically obedient child.
Right.
Now we've got a new kind of poet, quote unquote, right, whose learning language means becoming an unruly child, which for people like us who like that kind of poetry becomes good.
It is the individuals who finally get the feel of the tenses, so that it may snow, has to snow, on the muddy corpse. There is a boundary, mother, very far away and very continuous, broken, to interrogate civilians, the self, the text, networks of viewers found wanting a new way to cook chicken, why not, to kill while falling asleep. There is the one language not called money, and the other not called explosions.
How is it that you get to a point in the in a language you're learning because you're growing up, that you get the feel of the tenses?
Well, one of the weird things that maybe you guys experience is when you see events go by that are sort of traumatic, you know, you sometimes think, like, geez, I thought of, have I lived this? Or, you know, political landscapes and timescapes are very, very confusing in terms of what causes, you know, what, especially in a transitional period, especially in the transition of an individual consciousness of a person, right? So I think that's what he means. And if you look at it, the next line is kind of a reversal of time causality, right? So he says, so that it may snow, has to snow on the muddy corpse, almost as if there's a sort of prescient, you know, like an understanding that something is going to happen, but it's already known that it's going to happen. And that's
really
creepy.
Baio says that his mother lifts his collar not to make it, to prevent it, I'm not looking at the translation, not to prevent it from snowing, but so that it may snow. So then he's, again, borrowing that
going
situation
further.
So that, and exactly, and taking it further and really taking it a little bit toward, to me at least, a little bit toward Vallejo himself, who was if not a muddy corpse, well on his way to being one when he was
It's a very affecting image.
Yes.
On the verge of cliche, you know, you know, there's an atrocity, and of course once it's snow, nature does its leveling thing and everything is white, and you know, it's a pretty risky use of the Vallejo. So you begin that stanza, the last stanza, with the tenses, with language, and you end with there is the one language not called money. What the heck does that
mean? That's weird, huh?
This assumes that a lot of, I'm just being literal here, this assumes that a lot of the languages one could think of are called money.
Well, it's the one and the other. It's not there is one and there isn't. It's the one and the other. There is the one language not called money and the other not called explosions. So, again, you know...
Two languages.
Yeah, not just two languages, but two situations. You know, one money, one explosions, one, if you will, private, featureless exchange, you know, that one that hides things, one in which you can hide, and one which takes that apart.
Does this poem speak either of those languages?
Well, I think that the poem is sort of about the language of money and about the language of explosions. And what this final line does is simply calls attention to the fact that those are not the names of either of those languages. One language basically flat out is money, but it's not called that. One language kind of flat out is explosions, but we don't call it that.
Yes, that's really right on. That is that it is a comment on the use of language to cover up what is happening, what it's saying. Operation Patio, Operation Menu.
Especially after like the word called, right, appears like three times. It's called, right? So it's like a forceful separation, right? Like you know, something that's been pulled apart, but thinking about it is horribly close and scary. And
before we get to the Gathering Paradise segment of our show, let me ask each of you to offer a brief final word on the poem, or maybe something more on what you get from it. Sarah, do you want to start?
Sure. I think for me what I get from the poem is sort of a really interesting way to think about the kind of maybe sadness that's part of the difficulty of being the unruly child. I think we often want to think of somebody who's a bit rebellious, who stands to the side, who doesn't want to go along with things that they know are problematic. We think of that person as being heroic and kind of strong in themselves. And I think one thing that this poem gives us is a way of thinking about what's difficult in taking on that position. How do you address someone who maybe doesn't want to take a more rebellious stance, who wants to go along with things? I think the mother is sort of put in the position in that poem, and I think one of the things this poem does is show us how difficult it can be to speak to that mother, who's maybe not the rebellious figure that the unruly child is, how that's hard for the unruly child.
Thank you. Interesting. Tom?
Oh, gosh, I had something really brilliant to say, but it just dropped straight out of my head. I think of this poem as the difficult, you know, wrestling with an exuberant person, always able, out of intellectual brilliance, which characterizes Bob and especially characterized him when he was young, to explode in every direction from any situation and take it someplace in language, who is in conflict with himself about what am I doing, what am I going to do, and for whom this poem is a way of wrestling with that tendency in himself. It's a really, it's deep, and I'm amazed that I didn't see that when I read it first, and happy that I had the opportunity to come to see it.
Thank you, and you're welcome for the opportunity to do that. Rodrigo.
One thing I was thinking was that the poem, to my mind, could have been titled To Kill While Falling Asleep, which is
great
one of
line.
The penultimate line there, ending of a line. And, you know, if you think of sleep as a sort of break in, you know, this melismata, this consciousness that's billowing up into, you know, higher and higher abstractions of social meaning, whether they're legitimate or not. And when there's a break in that, I mean, is he saying, you know, to kill while falling asleep is good or is bad? You know, it's almost like here, that's the most ambiguous part of it, are these deaths, you know, political deaths absolutely necessary? I mean, in terms of consciousness, not actual people and stuff like that. Bob would never, you know. But that's my sort of thinking on the poem.
That's pretty unruly.
That's very unruly. And also, one more thing. You might also think that the mother's unruly. I mean, you say something enough times, and you say, I'm an unruly child, unto my mother, then you start wondering about that person's mother and whether that, you know.
Well, I don't usually take the final word, but I can't resist pushing a little bit on my mama reading. I think I agree with what folks have said, and I just look at the boundary and the idea here that there's a series of solids, mother, called people. It seems to be a classic problem of separation. If you don't separate unambiguously enough from the parent, then things don't linguistically and politically develop, quote-unquote, normally and conventionally. So there's, and I think it's actually a metaphor. I don't think that there's a real, that Bob Perlman has a mama problem. But I think that it becomes a way of talking about the unruliness of language and the mix of domestic and political languages, and unapologetically. And Vallejo gives him a start on that. We like to end Poem Talk with a minute or two of Gathering Paradise, a chance for several of us to spread wide our narrow hands to gather a little something poetically good to hail or commend someone or something going on in the poetry world. So who wants to gather a little paradise? Sarah, you look like someone who's about to gather some paradise.
Okay. I've been listening to some recordings of the Canadian sound poet Angela Rawlings recently, and I know that in 2009 and 2010, actually, she's going to be performing in Belgium and also in Iceland. So I'm looking forward to hearing recordings of that. I think that should be really phenomenal.
Good call. Thank you for that suggestion. Rodrigo?
Well, I'm holding here a book titled On Spec. It's by Tyrone Williams. It was published last year. It's a fantastic book. I'd highly recommend it, especially if you're interested in complex work like Bob Perlman's. It does a lot of things, and I just want to give a shout out to it.
Thank you. Well, that's all the muddy corpses we have time for on Poem Talk today. Poem Talk at the Writer's House is a collaboration of the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing and the Kelly Writer's House at the University of Pennsylvania and the Poetry Foundation, poetryfoundation.org. Thanks to my guests, Sarah Dowling, Tom Mandel, and Rodrigo Toscano, and to Poem Talk's director and engineer, James Lemaire, and to our fabulous Rotterdam-based editor, Steve McLaughlin. Next time on Poem Talk, if all goes well, Alan Loney, Herman Beavers, and Mecca Sullivan join me to talk about Amiri Baraka's early poem, Kenyatta, Listening to Mozart. This is Al Filreis, and I hope you'll join us again soon for that or another Poem Talk.